So today with me on the Loopcast, I have Haider Alkhoei, who is a scholar of Shiism and a scholar of, I mean, if people in our audience have studied Iraq or Iran or modern Shiism, his name has come up repeatedly. He's very much a respected scholar. So today we're going to talk about Shiism in the modern world. So we're going to look at basically, I think the time frame is going to be from the middle of the 20th century to today, and sort of try to figure out, the role of Shiism in politics, and not only within Islam but also within politics, because I think for a Western audience we have a very much bent view in the sense that we only see Shiism through the lens of the Iraq War or through Iran or through books like the Shia Revival or sort of pop literature that isn't really, it's not in-depth research. So today we're going to do very much a conversation trying to figure out Shiism in sort of the modern world and in Islam. So let's start with, describe Shiism in the modern world to us in the sense that, in the sense of the relationship between the faith, between the state, the Shiite, the clergy, and its followers. I mean, I think, when we first look at Shiism, it's I think politically in its relationship to the state, it's very different than Sunni Islam. So, I mean, walk us through the its relationship between the state, the clergy, and its followers.
I mean, I think first of all, it's important to bear in mind Shi'ism or the Shia are not a monolithic block. It's much less centralized, much less of a hierarchy. So I suppose it depends where you're looking at specifically. In the Gulf, for example, in Kuwait and Oman, the Shia are much better off than in Saudi and Bahrain, where they have long-standing issues with the government. In Malaysia, Indonesia, there have been recent campaigns of persecution against the Shia minority. In the Middle East, in Iraq, Iran, and Lebanon, they're very much in positions of power. But I think you can study Shiism or the Shia by looking much more in depth at the local context, which continent, which country, even which city, because it varies drastically from one place to the other.
Interesting. I mean, so within the context of the faith, I mean, do you have Shia Ikhwan in the sense of Islamists like the Muslim Brotherhood who were essentially lay people, people who weren't clergy, who used religion as a way to access politics? Because as I think it, we'll get into this, but looking at the faith, at least politically, it seems it's more clerics and sort of men of the religious hierarchy and not necessarily lay people.
I think it's interesting you said Shia Ikhwan, because the oldest Shia political party in Iraq, which grew out of the 1950s, the Islamic Da'wah Party, incidentally, the leader of which is the current Prime Minister of Iraq, they were very heavily influenced by the Muslim Brotherhood. And if you speak to any of the older members and the leaders of the party, they'll tell you, quite frankly, they grew up on the literature of the Muslim Brotherhood. And in terms of the clergy and the lay people, I suppose there's a big shift, a big divide in terms of the relationship of the relationship between the state and the clergy. Some Shia, I believe, by virtue of the jurist being the highest ranking Shia official, he should have legitimacy and authority to rule directly. And the more traditional school in Shiism, that's very much represented by Najaf, says actually it takes a much more apolitical role, much less direct role, and does not see under any circumstances a religious grounds for a government led by the Shia clergy. It would be illegitimate in their view, and there's no evidence in the scripture to justify it. So there's a big divide within Shiism today.
I'm very curious. I mean, it seems with that divide, you can sort of almost look at Iraq and Iran as models for that divide, because even though, I mean, both states have undergone huge political flux in the last 30 years, where you had the Iranian Revolution, and Iraq, you had the Iraq War. Trap my own sentence structure, but what I want to ask, I mean, is, in those times of change and where the state itself is being altered and sort of, to use a lack of a better phrase, even being destroyed and sort of reset. I mean, what is sort of what has been the role of the clergy and the clerics in this?
I mean, again, the Iraq-Iran example is very interesting because although in the mid-20th century, late 20th century, this solidified in terms of the success of the Iranian revolution and the traditional school in Najaf. But if you actually read the literature, first of all, this debate goes back 1,000 years. I suppose it's important to just note here quickly the two most central concepts within Shiism itself, not the only two, but the two real central ones that affect the clergy and the lay people in terms of their relationship with the state and society. One is the justice of God, this divine concept of justice that all Shia believe in. But secondly, it's the manifestation of that justice on earth. So after the death of the Prophet, you had the what's termed as the first crisis in the political history of Islam, in terms of the original split between the Shias and the Sunnis. The Sunnis believed the caliphate, believed in the legitimacy of the caliphate. The Shia didn't. They believed in divinely appointed imams. And for about 300 years, this manifestation of divine justice I refer to was manifested in these Shia imams. However, the last Shia imam in the mid 10th century went into major occultation. He went into hiding. And this marked a second crisis within the Shia in terms of how do I phrase this? It laid out the initial separation between theology and jurisprudence within the Shia school of thought in Islam. Because during the time of the divinely appointed guides, the theological aspect and the jurisprudential aspect manifested itself into one institution or one being, which was the imams themselves. However, after the absence of the imam, the Shia went through a very big crisis and gave a very prominent position to the faculty of intellect and reasoning to figure out exactly what they're supposed to do. There is no more infallible guide who can lead the community. And I suppose over centuries, they developed their own coherent body of legal jurisprudence. And the whole Iraq-Iran thing I said was interesting because even 400 years before Khomeini, clerics within Shiism were having this debate. Is it legitimate to be part of the state or to rule the state, or should we stay out of it altogether? So in the early 16th century, after the rise of the Safavids in Persia, and they chose Shiism as the official state religion, there was a mass movement of clerics from Bahrain, from Lebanon, from Iraq, and the Safavids imported them to Iran, to Persia, to Isfahan, to solidify not just their grip on power, but the religious legitimacy of that. And interestingly, you had a cleric in Najaf constantly in contact and sending letters with the main cleric in Iran, and it very much went along the lines of today's current debate between the clerics in Iraq and the clerics in Iran. The clerics in Iran were saying, no, the Safavid state is here. We have a legitimate role to play and to lead society along our Shia beliefs. And the clerics in Najaf were saying, this is absolutely not the case. With or without the presence of a state, whether it's Shia or not, we cannot assume such a big role and responsibility. So this whole Iraq-Iran thing, of course, again, became very stark in 1965 in Najaf when Khomeini went into exile. The Shah essentially kicked him out and he came to Najaf. And throughout the 60s and 70s, he began giving a series of lectures justifying his movement, his revolution, but the key concept was this idea of an Islamic government. And even when he was in Najaf, years before the success of the Iranian Revolution, there was this debate on, hang on a minute, you got too far. Our roles as jurists should be very much limited to guiding the people, offering them religious advice, and shouldn't go beyond that. And Khomeini was saying, no, according to my understanding of the literature and of the scripture, we do have to assume this this role in actually leading, in actually setting up an Islamic government. And the traditional school in Najaf till this day, very clearly and on numerous occasions, lays out it is against Islamic government. And indeed, I believe there can never be a legitimate Islamic government until the reappearance of the hidden imam who went into occultation in the mid 10th century. So whichever school you are within Shiism, you believe this imam is going to reappear and establish a just and legitimate government. And the debate today is essentially saying that there can never be one camp says there can never be a legitimate Islamic government until that day. And the second, more revolutionary, more activist school of thought says, no, we can establish an Islamic government in preparation for the coming of the Imam who will guide mankind.
So I'm curious, where do you put the institution of the Majid Taqlid, the idea of the religious leaders from the perspective of followers should be emulated and sort of you, I don't, I mean, I'm sure you can explain this better, but I mean, where do we put this institution? I mean, do we consider it a religious institution, or do we consider it a political institution? Where do we put the idea of Majid Taqlid?
No, I think it's very much a religious concept and religious injunction, not a political one. And the idea of this marja'a taqlid of emulating somebody who essentially knows more about Islam than you do, and somebody who does all the hard work for you by reading the text, reading the scripture, and coming to conclusions and positions on what is forbidden and not forbidden. But the concept itself, not called marja'a taqlid, but this concept of asking somebody who knows better than you on matters, on important matters of Islam, actually stems, way back to the 7th, 8th, 9th century. The imams I talked about, the ones who Shia believe were divinely appointed by the imams, would have representatives in different cities for the Shia who can refer back to them. And we even have examples of people, let's say from Khurasan in Iran, in Persia, who come to the imam and ask him, it could be a simple or complicated matter on religion. And the imam, instead of answering him, will respond with, but so and so is in your city and he represents me. You should go to him and ask. He has essentially the authority to give you my opinion. But the institution of Marja'a Taqlid is much more recent, last 100 and 150 years, where it became a central concept within the Shia school, whereby from that point on, the Shia were divided into two main camps. One is either you're a marja' yourself, you study for years to reach the level of ijtihad where you can come to conclusions based on the scripture and text. And of course, that's very difficult, and hence why we have very few, relatively very few marja' taqlids or sources of emulation that the people can go to. And the second, which is the overwhelming majority of the Shia, are muqallideen, those who emulate and those who refer back to these scholars. So it's a religious concept that became central in the last century and a half, and of course still plays a very important role today. And I suppose I should mention there are a minority of Shia who don't believe in this concept. They don't believe they believe that the narrations and the scripture and the text is it's too complicated for for the average human mind, and we shouldn't delve into these and give positions one way or other. So they don't believe in the institution itself. the institution of the marja al-taqlid. But for the overwhelming majority of Shia, it's very much an important part of their daily lives.
So I'm sort of curious, how fluid is the relationship with the clergy and the state? Because it seems like, I think in Iran the example is clear that the Ayatollah is not only the head of religion, Khamenei is not only the head of the faith in Iran, but also the head of the state. But it seems in Iraq it's much more fluid. I mean, Sistani, I mean, from what I understand of it, in our sort of previous conversations on Iraq, he stays out of politics, but his representatives are sort of, engaging in politics and sort of even, discussing political issues. So I'm sort of curious, I mean, in Iraq, how fluid is the relationship of the clergy to the state and vice versa?
Well, I mean, it's very fluid, but I should just quickly mention it. In Iran, it's very fluid as well. I mean, despite the structure of the state and the institution of Wilayat al-Faqih, which gives the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei both religious and political supremacy, there are both followers and clerics who live in Iran who don't subscribe to the theory. And of course, many people will tell you. And indeed, there's been a study of this done in 2006 by Mehdi Khallaji, that even in Iran, which is governed by the system of Wilayat al-Faqih, Ayatollah Sistani himself has more followers in Iran than Khamenei does. So, nobody can dispute Khamenei's political supremacy, but in terms of his religious supremacy, that's very much open to debate. And indeed, besides Khamenei and Sistani, there are other grand ayatollahs who do have followers. So in Iran, it's not as fluid as people might assume. But in Najaf, I mean, it's difficult to say Sistani doesn't get involved in political affairs. I mean, we all know he's as a product of the seminary in Najaf, he has a quietist or neo-quietist, as some refer to it, position. In terms of his own ideology of where the relationship should be between himself and the state, we do know he's very reluctant to get involved in politics. He only does it as a last resort. And for the past 7 years or 8 years, he's taken very much a backstage in Iraqi politics, very rarely intervening directly or indirectly. But in 2003, 2004, Sistani took very strong positions on politics. And I think we must, rather than say he's sort of coming out of his quietist position and moving on to a much more activist position, it really at the time depended on the circumstances. I mean, in Sistani's own statements that he's issued, and these have been published subsequently, he makes it very clear his fear of the American occupation authorities essentially drawing the lines and shaping the future of Iraq in a way that would not be in the interests of the majority of the Iraqi people. And here specifically, Sistani's interventions can be seen in the context of his adamant position of having the constitution and the identity of Iraq itself be linked with Islam. And of course, this is very different from having an Islamic government or religious state. But on more than one occasion, journalists in 2003 and 2004 asked him, what is your biggest fear? What is your biggest fear for the future of Iraq? And also bear in mind, it wasn't as bad in terms of the security and terrorism problems Iraq had. And he replied by saying, "My biggest fear is that the cultural identity of Iraq," and he was very specific in his wording, and he said, "of which Islam plays a central role, would be undermined." So his interventions in politics were mainly to enshrine the identity of Islam and link it with the Iraqi state, and he feared the Americans, even though came to Iraq to establish democracy, initially pursued very undemocratic means of governance in terms of trying to have a caucus-based constitutional assembly. They didn't want direct elections. And of course, Sistani eventually forced them to abandon their plans and hold direct elections because he saw that as the most legitimate way to represent the will and the majority of the people.
So let me ask you a sort of more theoretical question then. I mean, what is the relationship of democracy to Shiism? It seems like even in Iran, you know, the image of democracy is maintained of electing officials and popular participation. And even in Iraq, I mean, you know, it seems like democracy was sort of, I mean, you know, there's critiques of this saying that it's majoritarian rule or, you know, whatever. But I mean, you know, as a matter of theory and as a matter of religion, I mean, what is the relationship of, you know, of democracy and self-rule to the religion, to the faith? I mean,
you know, it's a very complicated question you're asking. And the constitution itself, many people see it as a contradiction in terms, because Article 2, or Article 1, I think it is, you know, the article which establishes that no laws can be passed that contradict the principles of Islam. Straight away, another one says, you know, nothing can be passed that contradicts the principles of democracy. So this concept of Islam or Islamic identity and Islamic legislation and democracy were very much twinned together, you know, during the birth of the Iraqi constitution and the new Iraqi state. But I suppose for the clerics, it's not a contradiction. This marriage between Islam and democracy not only isn't a contradiction, but is the most legitimate combination to pursue for Iraq's future, in that the majority of the Iraqi people are Muslims. They you know, the overwhelming majority of the Iraqis are Muslim, and yet the concept of democracy and the representation of the majority and the will of the majority, it's combined into one phenomena.
Interesting. So let's move away from our, you know, our discussion on governance and sort of the relationship of the clergy to the state to, you know, I think Najaf and Qom are very much important cities in Shiism. And I think they're cities that have sort of defined the faith in one way or the other. You know, how would you describe their sort of...
Sorry, that's my daughter crying.
No, it's okay. How would you describe sort of the modern relationship between Najaf and Qom? I mean, is it adversarial? Is it, you know, friendship? What is that relationship? How would you describe it?
I would definitely not use the word adversarial. Yes, Najaf and Qom, they possibly by virtue of one being in Iraq and the other being in Iran, are probably the best example representation of the divide within the Shia school. But they're very much intertwined, and I think this is lost on lots of observers and commentators. And by intertwined, I mean there's a confluence of schools, teachers, institutions, money, thoughts, ideas. In Qom, you have, you know, I wouldn't say anti-Wilayat al-Faqih scholars who have set up shop and distribute stipends and pay clerics and teach the next generation of scholars. And in Najaf, you have pro-Wilayat al-Faqih institutions, whether they be cultural and educational, you know, to pump out literature or teachers who follow that approach to Shia Islam, which is the leading cleric should assume supremacy in any state. It's not adversarial, but they're just differences of opinion, and certainly many of the ones in both Najaf and Qom don't see this as a weakness. And if I remember correctly, I think it was a Washington Post reporter who, in late 2003, early 2004, he asked Sistani about this, you know, the flourishing of the Hausa in Najaf. And I think he also asked how would that affect Qom. And Sistani replied by saying, you know, these differences are natural. And I do hope Najaf strengthens, and of course, post-2003, many of the clerics who were initially based in Qom came back to Iraq, or came to Iraq for the first time. Lots of the leading teachers who were in Qom came to Najaf. But Sistani says, I don't see this as a weakening for the school in Qom. And indeed, Sistani has a very massive and influential office in Qom. And for them, it's not, you know, clear cut. This is Najaf, this is Qom. It's part of one transnational seminary, but each has its own different opinion and approach. But I suppose the biggest, if you're looking at stark differences, the seminary in Iran and Qom, it's much more organized, it's much more institutionalized, it's much more centralized, both in terms of how the students are paid, or the courses, or how they're examined to progress in their studies. And in Najaf, it's much more relaxed. And I have friends who have studied in both, who continue actually to study in both schools. And in Iran, there are some compulsory courses you have to take. It's not up to you to choose who you study under. It's much more controlled in that respect, much more centralized. And in Najaf, it's much more open, it's much more free, and indeed many have argued much more intellectually independent, because there's no higher authority. So in Qom, the higher authority, of course, is the government, which sets out the rules, it lays down the lines, and it governs and controls the clerical establishment. Whereas in Iraq, it isn't. So people are freer to study what they want, where they want, and how they want. So I think that's a big difference between the schools in Najaf and Qom. It's the political and financial independence, and on the one side, the political and financial independence, and on the other side, the very system in which Islam is taught.
So can you describe sort of how politics is conducted between the two cities? I mean, is this, I think you made mention of sort of money going into the cities. I mean, even, I think, there's a joke that somebody told me in Iran that, it's somebody has to live in Iran, but his money can go to Najaf. And I think his insinuation was that, or not insinuation, the point he was getting at is that his zakat and homs and sort of religiously oriented money. I don't know if that's what you call it, but his money was flowing to Najaf, to Sistani, or, whatever cleric, he was giving his money to. So, I mean, in that sense, how do we describe politics, finance, economics, what is the non-religious aspect of this transnational connection?
I mean, the concept of khums, which is essentially religious taxes that Shia pay, it's 20% of the surplus income. That in itself is the biggest, benefit of the Najaf school. It's the one thing the clerics are most proud of. Because, as you say, people who live in Qom make their living in Iran, send back their money to Najaf. And I'm sure this happens vice versa. I'm sure there are some Iraqis who follow religious clerics in Iran, and they pay their taxes to them. But overwhelmingly, it's a one-way street. You literally have guys, with suitcases full of US dollars crossing the borders and going to their respective marja' taqlid, the people they follow, and giving them money. But in terms of I can't see the separation of politics and religion, because, just as an example, Sistani pays salaries in Iran, and Khamenei pays salaries in Iraq, and there's there's an unwritten rule, and I think it's done out of it must be done out of respect. Sistani pays just under the amount Khamenei pays, and Khamenei in Iraq pays just under the amount of Sistani. They don't pay more. But the key difference between the money is Sistani relies on, you know, Shia across the world, merchants, lay people, even other clerics, to finance his institution. Whereas in Iran, you don't need as many followers because you have the resources of the state. You are the supreme leader and you can dole out money where and as you see fit. So even in the distribution of wealth, there's a difference in terms of the sources of the money.
So, I mean, where do we put Karbala in all this? Because it seems like our major focus for as researchers is it always seems to be Najaf, Qom, maybe Isfahan, you know, maybe Mashhad. But, I mean, Karbala never gets mentioned beyond, you know, the stories of Hussein's martyrdom. And, you know, I haven't, I mean, at least here in the United States, I haven't been able to find a sort of a strong narrative of Karbala as a city and as a sort of participation in religion. So, I mean, where do we place the city of Karbala in all this?
I think in terms of the scholarship and media attention, the lack of focus is, to a very large degree, it's justified. Without downplaying the significance of the other schools in Shia Islam, you mentioned, you know, Isfahan, Mashhad, which also has a big religious seminary, and Karbala too, but they're not as prominent or significant as the ones in Najaf and Qom. I mean, Karbala is home to several very senior scholars, but the two big shrines are under the control of Sistani's representatives. So Karbala might have a slightly different political orientation, but it very much comes under the influence of Najaf and currently Sistani, both in terms of, you know, politics and religion. It's difficult to say this without downplaying, you know, the city. But I mean, in religious aspects, in terms of the scholarship, it's not on the same level as Najaf or Qom. So it's justified. I mean, the lack of attention, I think, is justified.
Interesting. So, you know, getting away from politics for a moment, I'm sort of curious, I mean, in your travels between Iraq and Iran and elsewhere, I mean, how does Shiism, what's the difference in practice between an Iraqi Shiite and an Iranian Shiite? I mean, it seems like, you know, I think when I was a master's student and we were sort of discussing Ashura and Karbala, it was very much very stark differences in sort of how each culture or each sort of group represent, even the basic, you know, the idea of the martyrdom of Hussein. So I'm sort of curious, I mean, you know, how would you describe each state's approach to Shiism in the sense of, you know, how an individual experiences it?
I think if you're looking at the religious aspect, you know, the religious obligations, there's virtually no difference, you know, at all between, you know, whether it's Iraqi, Iranian, Pakistani, or Indian. It's one faith, it's one belief. But of course, you have localized contexts, and the culture is very different from one place to another. So the example you mentioned is the classic example, because it's the expression of mourning to mark the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. And that, even within the Arab world, there'll be very different ways of expressing this. So if you travel to Bahrain or Saudi or Iraq or Syria, there's different... I suppose it's mainly cultural. I mean, the many of the things the Indian Shia do or the Pakistani Shia do, you know, Iraqi Shia may not necessarily identify or relate with it, but it doesn't change the religious experiences per se. It's more of a a difference in expressing your Shi'ism that's based on where you are in the society you grew up in.
So I'm sort of curious, I mean, has the ideologies of the state affected this individual expression of faith? I mean, because it seems like in Iraq, what you've described is very not freewheeling, but very much a clergy and a community of the faithful that's not necessarily being influenced by the state, actively influenced by the state. Whereas in Iran, it seems that, the faith is very much, I don't want to say state dominated, but very much influenced by the state. So, I mean, in that sense, how does an individual expression of religion, of the faith, sort of change based on the state's interaction with the faith?
See, I mean, I don't think it does, because if you're, a Shia, whether you're in Qom, New Delhi, Baghdad, Najaf, London, Washington D.C., your religious beliefs doesn't vary from one place to another. I can't. I mean, I don't see a. Actually, I don't see any difference at all. But in terms of the how it affects your daily lives, then yes, of course there would be a difference, but that's much more political than it is religious. And of course, Syria is the key example I can point to in terms of, religiously, there's not much that divides Shia, wherever they are, but politically. If you subscribe to the revolutionary activist Iranian model of Shi'ism, then you're much more likely, to be fighting in Syria. Whereas if you subscribe to the more traditional quietist or apolitical tradition, then you're much more likely not to go to Syria. But in terms of religious experiences, there's not much difference. How that plays out in reality, I think, all depends on politics.
And we'll get to Syria at the sort of the end of the interview, but let me take this line of questioning one step further. And does the state affect students and scholarship at the seminary schools? I mean, it seems like that if there's one thing I could take away from the history of Najaf and Qom is that there's a very sort of vibrant debate that is always going on. So I'm sort of curious. Does the clergy's relationship to the state and with the state affect sort of scholarship and what's being produced and what's being thought about and what's being written?
Oh, absolutely. So, for the decades that the Ba'ath were in power, though the state had a very much hands-off approach to, I suppose the state couldn't dictate to the clergy during Saddam's rule what it can and cannot study. But because of it, of the policies and politics it pursued and the repression it carried out, not just, on the clergy, but on Iraqis in general. It affected Najaf badly in terms of producing scholarship, in terms of the clerics who had to flee to Iran or Europe. And it left a massive gap. And hence, in the post-2003 Iraq, again, there was no arm of the state controlling anything really in Najaf, maybe besides security. And that's what allowed Najaf to flourish, in post-2003 Iraq, and continue to grow and continue to attract students from all over the world. Whereas in Iran post-79, then yes, of course, the state played a very important role. It had now had a direct hand in the seminary, what gets taught in the seminary, who studies in the seminary, and yeah, I suppose that can affect scholarship in other ways by making it more dependent on state funds.
So I want to sort of switch over to two sort of controversial issues in Shiism. And one is, the role of the younger leadership, and then we will sort of end the show with Syria. But, you know, in the topic of younger leaders in, or not leaders, but political leaders in Shiism, it seems like, you know, when you navigate the politics of the faith, you know, where do we place young men who don't have religious credentials, but have sort of risen to the position of leadership? And so sort of the men I'm referring to is Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq, Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon. I mean, it seems like these guys, you know, challenge the idea of the Majid-Tak lead in the sense that they don't necessarily need religious credentials, but rather, you know, the ability to be good political leaders. And not good political, you know, when I say good political leaders, I mean being able to sort of flourish in within their own context. So, I mean, you know, in that sense, can politics be used to go around this institution? And it's, you know, what does that say about the institution itself?
I think, first of all, Sadr and Nasrallah, it's not a question of not having religious credentials. It's a matter of not being on the same level as the much more senior clerics in Iraq and Iran. But I don't think they can go around the issue of marja' taqlid. They certainly don't pose a challenge to it. And the simple reason is because you can follow Muqtada al-Sadr or Hassan Nasrallah politically. I mean, you can have them as your role models, whilst in matters of faith in the issues and concepts of where you need to understand how to live your life, what is allowed, what is not allowed, you can follow one of the more senior marja' taqlid. So there's no the rise of the young clerics don't challenge the institution of marja' taqlid. They're very much in parallel with it. So, for example, Hezbollah members can, you know, by virtue of being Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah is their leader, and yet they can follow Khamenei or indeed any other cleric they want. It's not a clash per se. Yes, of course, they've used politics to rise and sort of, you know, have more say in the issues of government or regional politics and national politics, but they can't do away with the idea of marja' al-taqlid per se. It's very much become, you know, over the last century and a half, solidified in the Shia faith. So it's not as much of a contradiction as you might assume, or them being a challenge to this institution. They very much work under the umbrella of this institution. So Sadr, for a while, his followers, for religious purposes, followed Ha'iri as their marja' taqlid. And now I think there's, you know, differences of opinion and different members within the same party following different clerics. So it's certainly not a contradiction. So the younger clerics, the short answer is they work within the system of marja' taqlid. They cannot replace the top scholars purely because of their age and religious education. So they work with the system, not even around it.
Interesting. I'm sort of curious. I mean, is there a larger comment about sort of Sadr and Nasrallah's rise to power? Because it seems like, you know, they both sort of have risen to a position of prominence, not necessarily through, you know, their scholarly work, but rather their ability to navigate, you know, violence and sectarian politics. So, I mean, is there sort of, you know, the idea that, you know, instability or, you know, the lack of a stable state has sort of produced this class of leader? Or is, you know, is there a wider comment here about, you know, sectarianism and violence?
No, I think, I mean, they had an opportunity, they seized the opportunity, and they obviously have very powerful backers regionally that enable them to assume this this public political role. You're right. It's got very little to do with their religious scholarship and status or position, and everything to do with who funds them and who backs them. And in both the cases you've mentioned, it's the Islamic Republic of Iran. So they've utilized the prestige and resources of a state to rise, you know, through whether it be through violence or peaceful means. And they've done both. I mean, they've both fought very violent conflicts, and they've both used politics as a means to capture legitimacy in both Lebanon and Iraq.
I mean, would you consider, I mean, this is a fairly controversial question. I mean, would you consider Iran as a challenge to the institution of Marja Tekfir? Because it seems like, you know, Khamenei's ascent to power, you know, when Khomeini died was, you know, he was, I think the popular understanding of it is that he was a Hujjat al-Islam and was sort of elevated to the position of Ayatollah by, you know, I think Rafsanjani and a lot of political negotiation. But, you know, in this sense, I mean, do we consider Iran and the ideology of Veliaht-e Faqih as a sort of challenge to the institution of Marja Tekfir?
No, I mean, I don't think it's a challenge at all. I mean, the state, the Islamic Republic of a state, sorry, the Islamic Republic of Iran, in many ways couldn't have been born without the concept of Marja-e Taqlid. And yes, of course, in post-Khomeini Iran, the issue was politicized, and Khamenei, and I think they had to even change the constitution to fit in Khamenei within the system. I don't see it as a challenge to the issue of Marja Taqlid, A, because they are Marja Taqlids. I mean, they are part and parcel of this institution within Shi'ism. But B, the traditional school in Iraq is I wouldn't say unfazed, but it certainly won't be radically changed simply because of what happens on what goes on in Iran. It's a traditional school that's existed, you know, for almost 1,000 years, and will continue to do so with, you know, regardless of what happens in Iran.
I'm sort of curious then. I mean, has Iran's sort of export of the Islamic Revolution changed anything then? I mean, it seems like, you know, I think in the West, you know, we have this very much exaggerated perception of this exportation of Iran's ideology, but yet it seems like the way you've described it is that they haven't changed anything, at least fundamentally. So, I mean, you know, how do we consider Iran's, you know, export of Veliaht-e Faqih within the context of the clergy of Iraq and other places?
That's a good question. I mean, if you walk through the streets of Najaf, you can't miss the clues and hints of Iranian presence, whether it be the offices of clerics and the distribution of salaries, or much more subtle, you know, soft power influences in terms of the educational and cultural foundations, the many cultural and educational foundations they've set up. But yes, I don't think it's fundamentally changed the tradition itself. I suppose what I'm trying to say is Iran has tried to export their brand of Islam in Najaf, but what the West, and I think much of the Arab world, miss is the very strength of the traditional school in Najaf. So they paint a very bleak picture of post-Sistani Iraq, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was the Saudi press who initially, you know, raised the alarm bells, and it resonated quite powerfully in London and DC, of them essentially saying, "Look, Iran's opening up these offices. It has these clerics. It has these scholars. And after Sistani, they're going to be in a prime position to simply sweep up Najaf." And take over. But I think it was very much fear-mongering on behalf of the Saudis, and the West, I think, took a very uncritical look at it, and produced one article after the other saying post-Sistani Iraq is going to be dominated or very susceptible to Iranian influence. I don't think that's the case because there's a lot of Iranian influence in Najaf today, and it's not changing the centuries-old traditional school in Najaf. So I suppose what I'm trying to say is Iran is trying, but I don't think they're going to be successful. It's too much of an ask. So Khomeini in the you know, even before the Islamic Republic, his ideas won't taken up. Were not taken up by, you know, a good number of scholars in Iraq. They simply didn't see it as a valid concept. And today, the overwhelming majority of the scholars and students and teachers in Najaf also don't see it as a valid concept. You know, from the Grand Ayatollah down to the first year students, it's a very tall order to change something that took, you know, 1,000 years to develop simply by pumping in money into the school of Najaf.
So, I mean, what does a post-Sistani Iraq look like? I mean, I think this is definitely on a lot of sort of scholars' mind. I mean, it seems like Sistani has presided over Najaf over a very much a period of tumult and change, but he's, you know, what should we expect for a post-Sistani Iraq? Is it, you know, is it going to be sort of chaotic? What is it, is, you know, what should we expect?
I think it's important to bear in mind Sistani, as big and influential of a role he's played in Iraq, he's not an exception. He's a product of a school and of a tradition. He's a student of those who came before him, and he's very much so. His absence in Najaf may herald a period of, I wouldn't say chaos, but confusion maybe, uncertainty. You'll have different clerics, I suppose very crudely, if you want to think of this as a market, then there'll be different clerics who'll have different percentages in market share, and over a while it will converge on a single dominant scholar, or maybe you'll have two or three big players who are in, you know, equal in status. But a post-Sistani Iraq is going to look very much like a pre-Sistani Iraq in terms of its religious coloring and ideological position on the, you know, relationship between the state and religion. So whilst, you know, it'll be very hard for anybody, I think, to predict who's going to assume, you know, the mantle after Sistani, what we can assume quite confidently is it'll be somebody who subscribes to the non-revolutionary traditional school, because that's essentially what Najaf is and was built on.
I mean, do you consider, you know, Najaf under Sistani as a sort of centralized, where the flow of money and the flow of and the relationship of Sistani and his representatives to the city? I mean, is can we sort of regard his influence as centralizing, in that a post-Sistani Iraq, a post-Sistani Najaf would be more de would be sort of decentralized, where instead of one very prominent leader, you would have maybe one, two, or three, or four. I mean, is, you know, can we consider Sistani as a centralizing personality?
That's a tough question. So Sistani's centralizing role, I think, isn't a very accurate description of what's going on, you know, now as we speak. I think there are, you know, some people say multi-million, some people say multi-billion dollar enterprise that he runs, but it's not a very centralized system. And by that I mean his key representatives in Iran or the West have a very large degree of autonomy in the collection, distribution, and spending of that wealth. So we talked about money that flows in to Najaf by, you know, followers, but a lot of that is given to the representatives who spend it in Iran. And you know, I've traveled dozens of times to Iraq and Iran since 2003, and based just on observations, and I don't have statistics or figures, Sistani's empire, if you like, in Iran is much bigger than it is in Iraq in terms of the housing developments, the financial endowments, the buildings they run, they rent. It seems to be a big operation than it is in Najaf itself. And post Sistani, these will, I suppose, be divided between whoever succeeds him. So if Representative X decides after Sistani to throw all his weight behind Y, then that person will enjoy the prestige and financial benefits that has. So I don't think it'll be more centralized or less centralized. But in terms of what I said about one person or a couple of people or three people, eventually I do think, popular opinion, and popular opinion is going to play a big role in this. It's not just about the money, it's about who the people want to follow. I do think after initial period of confusion or uncertainty, it will converge towards one, particular grand ayatollah.
So I want to sort of go to our next question, and that is Syria. So I think what has become apparent in our previous conversations on Syria and Shiism in Syria is that it has very much become a sort of point of where a lot of Shiites are coming from across the world to fight. And I think in our conversations with Chris, he made the point that Sayyida Zainab, this shrine, is being used as a sort of a mobilizing factor, both in the media and as sort of, I think the argument in Shia militia media is, you come to Syria to sort of protect the shrine and to fight these jihadis. So Jabhat al-Nusra, the Islamic State of Iraq, Ash-Sham, and these organizations. So my question is that, can we consider Syria as a sort of Shia transnational jihad? In the vein of, the role that Afghanistan played in the 80s for Sunni jihadists, where it was acting as a sort of focus for sort of activist and extremist sort of tendencies. And, when I say extremist, I mean sort of what I mean is violent and sort of coming to Syria to fight.
I think you can, a pro-Iranian Shia transnational jihad will be a much more accurate description, I think, than just a Shia transnational jihad. Yes, Sayyida Zainab, as one of the holiest Shia shrines in Najaf, has formed, the central narrative of these fighters coming in from Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, and the fear of the destruction of this shrine is pulling young men to travel to Syria. But I think we need to look carefully at just exactly who is going to Syria. These militias are being organized, supported, trained by Iran, and they're, Iran's facilitating their travel, as is, I believe, the government of Iraq under Maliki. But I think you'll find very few Shia, regardless of where they sit on the, ideological divide, very few will believe that the reason the militias are going is solely to protect Sayyida Zainab. I'm not saying they're not doing that, and that doesn't, form the central purpose of their travel to Syria. But a lot of these militias are fighting alongside Assad's security forces. A lot of them are traveling outside Damascus, and it's. I think people are coming to see through this narrative of going to defend Sayyida Zainab. It is, I believe, an important it forms, even not for the pro-Iranian Shia, an important and legitimate fear of what will happen if this shrine comes under the control of Al-Qaeda, be they the Islamic State or Jabhat al-Nusra. But yeah, I wouldn't call it a Shia transnational jihad purely because underneath the Shia label or identity, a second level of analysis will reveal it's actually solely conducted by Iran and the militias that receive support from Iran.
So I'm sort of curious. I mean, it seems like it's politics being sort of, I'm sort of trying to work my way through this because it seems like, at the same time that Iran is sort of encouraging and pushing people to go to Syria to fight, it seems like on the level of sectarianism, it's creating a huge sort of sectarian backlash. I mean, the idea that, I think the fight in Syria now is, it almost seems starkly divided between Shia and Sunni. So, I mean, in that sense, I mean, is sort of the politics influencing the religion and then sort of the religion influencing the politics of, of this war?
Absolutely, and this is why you have a different approach from the clerics in Iran and the clerics in Iraq. So none of the Grand Ayatollahs in Iraq encourage young Shia to go to Syria to fight. And indeed, some of the clerics I spoke to just in my recent trip to Iraq believe that the threat itself is exaggerated. For political reasons, but in terms of the sectarian aspect, whilst I don't think anyone can deny that the Shia militias fighting in Syria is escalating this, but I think it's also important to bear in mind this didn't come out of a vacuum. There's been lots of talk in recent months of Hezbollah's role in Syria and how this has worsened the sectarian divide, but it's as important to bear in mind that Al-Qaeda affiliates and fighters from all over the Islamic world were already there in Syria fighting. So it became sectarian, I think, before the arrival of these militias.
I mean, it seems like Al-Qaeda and sort of the theme of sectarianism in Syria is very much related to the war in Iraq, because it seems like Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State of Iraq, as Shams, they're all sort of, the way I understand it, so correct me if I'm wrong, seem to be an outgrowth of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and that they're sort of bringing a lot of those sectarian themes from that war into the theater in Syria. So my sort of question is, I mean, how much, where do we put Iraq in terms of sort of this, in terms of sectarianism? I mean, has the war in Iraq sort of introduced a sort of sharpness to the themes of sectarianism in the way we sort of analyze relationships between, political relationships between Shia and Sunni?
I think, yes, I mean, I agree in terms of the role Al-Qaeda in Iraq played, and I think they were very open about the fact how they initially began supporting their affiliates in Syria with weapons, with training, with men, and eventually came to merge, and hence Al-Qaeda in Iraq is now Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Sham. But in terms of the role the Iraqi government is playing, it's adding to the sectarian conflict in Syria, and it's pursuing, and I wrote about this recently, a dual track foreign policy where publicly it says one thing, we're neutral, we want a political solution, and we want both sides of the conflict in Syria to sit down on the negotiating table. So this is what it says in public, and it always says in public, whether it's from the prime minister or the foreign minister. But in private, they are facilitating Iranian support to the Assad regime, as well as turning a blind eye to the Shia militiamen who are backed by Iran, but facilitated by definitely somebody in a position of power in Iraq. And one of my contacts in my recent trip to Iraq told me that they had traveled in their cars, which were official. They had official security passes, and they were traveling to Baghdad airport to fly on to Syria. So Iraq is playing a role in that, but its role isn't because of what Iran wants. The Iraqis are independently the Shia in Iraq, who dominate the government, are afraid of what's going to come after Assad, and afraid of empowering the same forces who are fighting in Syria in Iraq, and hence why they have a dual track policy. One's to sound less like hypocrites and say, we're not taking sides, and the other is they are taking sides, but it's because of what they perceive to be a threat to themselves.
I want to sort of get at the idea of sectarianism, because it seems like, a lot of Iraqi politics now is, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like a lot of Iraqi politics is being defined by sectarianism, by the division between Sunni and Shia. So I think, I'm sort of curious, what has been the clergy's view and what has been Najaf's view on the sectarianism, this new sort of, I don't want to say sectarian Iraq, but what is the view of this sort of division, this sort of blunter division between Sunni and Shia in Iraq?
And again, that's a very difficult question to answer properly. In the initial days, the clergy, and by the clergy I mean Sistani, he took very non-sectarian and indeed anti-sectarian positions. And one of the fears they had initially, his office and himself, was that the Americans would come into Iraq and, interestingly, enshrine ethno-sectarian politics in the post-2003 order. And a lot of his opposition to the Bush administration plans was to make sure that doesn't happen, that the new order isn't based on, the prime minister has to be Shia, the president has to be a Kurd, and the Speaker of Parliament has to be a Sunni. But ironically, the mechanism that the clergy pushed for, which was, one man, one vote, free and fair democratic elections, has produced this system. So hence why some people say, yes, the clergy were anti-sectarian, but they were against the Bush administration because they felt they were pursuing, ethno-sectarian politics. They eventually led themselves to the creation of this ethno-sectarian system. But throughout the horrific sectarian and civil war, the clergy maintained a anti-sectarian position by constantly calling on the Shia to show self-restraint in the face of Al-Qaeda attacks. So it's a weird situation where they were anti-sectarian and yet some believe played a role in the order that exists now in Iraq. And an analyst I spoke to recently said that this itself is the reason why they've kept such a distance between themselves and the politicians. So for a few years now, the clergy refused to sit down with politicians and to meet with politicians. And a friend of mine was saying it's because they regret the role they played themselves in bringing these people to power. So it's a very complicated relationship.
So, where would you put, Muqtada al-Sadr then? He seems to not only have been an active participant, but also now is in, I think, in power. I haven't kept up with Iraqi politics post, 2011, 2012, but it seems like, what you've described is that Sistani and the clergy, the official clergy, have sort of, are anti-sectarian or, don't necessarily want sectarianism, to the extreme. But it seems like with Sadr, he was, at least from 2004 to 2008, was an active participant. And then from 2008 on is now a politician. So, how do we reconcile Sadr's role and sort of sectarianism in Iraq.
I mean, yeah, it's a very contradictory one, because as you say, the Mehdi army, the armed wing of his political movement, was constantly pursuing violence ever since the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. They played a very big role in the horrific revenge attacks we saw post Samarra shrine destruction in 2006. On several occasions, the Iraqi government fought him directly and tried to rein in his militias, twice in 2004, and most famously in 2008. Then he sort of disappeared by going to Iran to pursue his religious studies. And now he hasn't abandoned violence per se and come to politics. He always used them in conjunction with each other. But now he appears to have reshaped or redesigned his party. He's seen as a more, ironically, more of a, how shall I say, accommodating figure than the prime minister himself. So he is trying to change that legacy of his. How successful he'll be, I suppose, depends on how easily the Iraqis forget the role he played in 2006 and 2007.
So I think we've covered a lot today. I think this is almost a master's class in Shiism in the modern world. But as a sort of policy on the show, we always like to get the guest to give us a last word. Did we miss anything? Sort of a summary comment. Whatever they sort of see fit. So, give us a last word or whatever.
I mean, one of my pet peeves on this issue is the portrayal of the Shia as one monolithic block that's sort of controlled by Iran and this equation that people seem to have in their minds where Iran equals Shia and Shia equals Iran. And so, yeah, I suppose my last word would be that Shiism is a lot more complicated and a lot more nuanced than that general assumption.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Sina.
Sure.